Chapter 6. Unless you beg my pardon for having behaved so. Pearson could not quite bring himself to see that he had behaved badly to his too imperious lady, and declined to ask forgiveness for what he had not done. She thereupon left the room. Later in the day she re-entered, and broke a silence by saying bitterly, I showed temper just now, as you told me. But things have causes, and it is perhaps a mistake that you should have deserted a vice for me. Instead of wedding Rosaline, Romeo must needs go eloping with Juliet. It was a fortunate thing for the affections of those two Veronese lovers that they died when they did. In a short time the enmity of their families would have proved a fruitful source of dissension. Juliet would have gone back to her people, he to his. The subject would have split them as much as it splits us. Pearson laughed a little. But Marcia was painfully serious, as he found at tea time, when she said that since his refusal to beg her pardon as he had been thinking over the matter, and had resolved to go to her aunt's after all at any rate till her father could be induced to agree to their union. Pearson was as chilled by this resolve of hers as he was surprised at her independence in circumstances which usually make women the reverse. But he put no obstacles in her way, and, with a kiss strangely cold after their recent ardor, the Romeo of the Freestone Montagues went out of the hotel, to avoid even the appearance of coercing his Juliet of the rival house. When he returned she was gone. A correspondence began between these two hastily pledged ones, and it was carried on in terms of serious reasoning upon their awkward situation on account of the family feud. They saw their recent love as what it was. Too rash, too unadvised, too sudden, too like the lightning. They saw it with an eye whose calmness, coldness, and, it must be added, wisdom, did not promise well for their reunion. Their debates were clinched by a final letter from Marcia, sent from no other place than her recently left home in the Isle. She informed him that her father had appeared suddenly at her aunt's, and had induced her to go home with him. As he had told her father all the circumstances of their elopement, and what mere accidents had caused it. He had persuaded her on what as he had almost been convinced of by their disagreement, that all thought of their marriage should be at least postponed for the present, any awkwardness and even scandal being better than that they should immediately unite themselves for life on the strength of a 2 or 3 days' resultless passion, and be the wretched victims of a situation they could never change. Pearson saw plainly enough that he owed it to her father being a born islander, with all the ancient island notions of matrimony lying underneath his acquired conventions, that the stone merchant did not immediately insist upon the usual remedy for a daughter's precipitancy in such cases, but preferred to await issues. But the young man still thought that Marcia herself, when her temper had quite cooled, and she was more conscious of her real position, would return to him, in spite of the family hostility. There was no social reason against such a step. In birth the pair were about on one plane, and though Marcia's family had gained a start in the accumulation of wealth, and in the beginnings of social distinction, which lent color to the feeling that the advantages of the match would be mainly on one side, Pearson was a sculptor who might rise to fame, so that potentially their marriage could not be considered inauspicious for a woman who, beyond being the probable heiress to a considerable fortune, had no exceptional opportunities. Thus, though disillusioned, he felt bound in honor to remain on call at his London address, as long as there was the slightest chance of Marcia's reappearance, or of the arrival of some message requesting him to join her, that they might, after all, go to the altar together. Yet in the night he seemed to hear sardonic voices, and laughter in the wind at this development of his little romance, and during the slow and colorless days he had to sit, and behold the mournful departure of his well-beloved from the form he had lately cherished, till as he had almost vanished away. The exact moment of her complete withdrawal Pearson knew not, but not many lines of her were longer discernible in Marcia's remembered contours, nor many sounds of her in Marcia's recalled accents. Their acquaintance, though so fervid, had been too brief for such lingering. There came a time when he learned, through a trustworthy channel, two pieces of news affecting himself. One was the marriage of a Vice Carol with her cousin, the other that the Bencombes had started on a tour round the world, which was to include a visit to a relation of Mr. Bencombe's who was a banker in San Francisco. Since retiring from his former large business, the stone merchant had not known what to do with his leisure, and finding that travel benefited his health, he had decided to indulge himself thus. Although he was not so informed, Pearson concluded that Marcia had discovered that nothing was likely to happen as a consequence of their elopement, and that as he had accompanied her parents, he was more than ever struck with what this signified her father's obstinate antagonism to her union with one of his blood and name. 1.9. Familiar phenomena in the distance, by degrees Pearson began to trace again the customary lines of his existence, and his profession occupied him much as of old. The next year or two only once brought him tidings, through some residents at his former home, of the movements of the Bencombes. The extended voyage of Marcia's parents had given him quite a zest for other scenes and countries, and it was said that her father, a man still in vigorous health except at brief intervals, was utilizing the outlook which his cosmopolitanism afforded him by investing capital in foreign undertakings. What he had supposed turned out to be true. Marcia was with him. No necessity for joining him had arisen, and thus the separation of himself and his newly married wife by common consent was likely to be a permanent one. It seemed as if he would scarce ever again discover the carnate dwelling place of the haunting minion of his imagination. Having gone so near to matrimony with Marcia as to apply for a license, he had felt for a long while morally bound to her by the incipient contract, and would not intentionally look about him in search of the vanished ideality. Thus during the first year of Miss Bencombe's absence, when absolutely bound to keep faith with the elusive one's late incarnation, if she should return to claim him, this man of the odd fancy would sometimes tremble at the thought of what would become of his solemn intention if the phantom were suddenly to disclose herself in an unexpected quarter and seduce him before he was aware. Once or twice he imagined that he saw her in the distance at the end of a street, on the far sands of a shore, in a window, in a meadow, at the opposite side of a railway station, but he determinedly turned on his heel and walked the other way. During the many uneventful seasons that followed Marcia's stroke of independence, for which he was not without a secret admiration at times, Jocelyn threw in two plastic creations, that ever-bubbling spring of emotion which, without some conduit into space, will surge upwards and ruin all but the greatest men. It was probably owing to this, certainly not on account of any care or anxiety for such a result, that he was successful in his art, successful by a seemingly sudden spurt, which carried him at one bound over the hindrances of years. He prospered without effort. He was a R.A., but recognitions of this sort, social distinctions, which he had once coveted so keenly, seemed to have no utility for him now. By the accident of being a bachelor, he was floating in society without any soul anchorage or shrine that he could call his own, and, for want of a domestic center round which honors might crystallize, they dispersed impalpably without accumulating and adding weight to his material well-being. He would have gone on working with his chisel with just as much zest if his creations had been doomed to meet no mortal eye but his own. This indifference to the popular reception of his dream figures lent him a curious artistic aplomb that carried him through the gusts of opinion without suffering them to disturb his inherent bias. The study of beauty was his only joy for years onward. In the streets he would observe a face, or a fraction of a face, which seemed to express to a hair's breadth in mutable flesh what he was at that moment wishing to express in durable shape. He would dodge and follow the other like a detective. In omnibus, in cab, in steamboat, through crowds, into shops, churches, theaters, public houses, and slums mostly, when at close quarters, to be disappointed for his pains. In these professional beauty chases he sometimes cast his eye across the Thames to the wharves on the south side, and to that particular one whereat his father's tons of freestone were daily landed from the catches of the south coast. He could occasionally discern the white blocks lying there, vast cubes so persistently nibbled by his parent from his island rock in the English Channel, that it seemed as if in time it would be nibbled all away. One thing it passed him to understand. On what field of observation the poets and philosophers based their assumption, that the passion of love was intensest in youth and burned lower as maturity advanced. It was possibly because of his utter domestic loneliness that, during the productive interval which followed the first years of Marcia's departure, when he was drifting along from 25 to 38, Pearson occasionally loved with an ardor though, it is true, also with a self-control unknown to him, when he was green in judgment. His whimsical ill-bred fancy had grown to be such an emotion, that the well-beloved now again visible was always existing somewhere near him. For months he would find her on the stage of a theater. Then she would flit away, leaving the poor, empty carcass that had lodged her to mum on as best it could without her a sorry lay figure to his eyes, heaped with imperfections and sullied with commonplace. She would reappear, it might be, in an at first unnoticed lady, met at some fashionable evening party, exhibition, bazaar, or dinner, to flit from her, in turn, after a few months, and stand as a graceful shop girl at some large drapery warehouse into which he had strayed on an unaccustomed errand. Then she would forsake this figure, and redisclose herself in the guise of some popular authoress, piano player, or fiddleress, at whose shrine he would worship for perhaps a 12-month. Once she was a dancing girl at the Royal Moorish Palace of Varieties, though during her whole continuance at that establishment he never once exchanged a word with her, nor did she first or last ever dream of his existence. He knew that a 10 minutes' conversation in the wings with the substance would send the elusive haunter scurrying fearfully away into some other even less accessible masked figure. She was a blonde, a brunette, tall, petite, svelte, straight-featured, full, curvilinear. Only one quality remained unalterable. Her instability of tenure. In Bourne's phrase, nothing was permanent in her but change. It is odd, apostrophe he said to himself, that this experience of mine, or idiosyncrasy, or whatever it is, which would be sheer waste of time for other men, creates sober business for me. Apostrophe apostrophe for all these dreams he translated into plaster, and found that by them, he was hitting a public taste he had never deliberately aimed at, and mostly despised. He was, in short, in danger of drifting away from a solid artistic reputation to a popularity which might possibly be as brief as it would be brilliant and exciting. You will be caught someday, my friend, apostrophe Summers would occasionally observe to him. I don't mean to say entangled in anything discreditable, for I admit that you are in practice as ideal as in theory. I mean the process will be reversed. Some woman, whose well-beloved flits about as yours does now, will catch your eye, and you will stick to her like a limpet, while she follows her phantom, and leaves you to ache as you will. Apostrophe apostrophe, you may be right, but I think you are wrong, apostrophe said Pearson. As flesh she dies daily, like the apostle's corporeal self, because when I grapple with the reality she's no longer in it, so that I cannot stick to one incarnation if I would. Apostrophe apostrophe, wait till you are older, apostrophe said Summers. Part second, a young man of 40, since love will needs, that I shall love, of very force I must agree. And since no chance may it remove in wealth and in adversity I shall alway myself apply to serve and suffer patiently. Apostrophe apostrophe Sir T. Wyatt. 2. 1. The old phantom becomes distinct. In the course of these long years, Pierston's artistic emotions were abruptly suspended by the news of his father's sudden death at Sandburn, whither the stone merchant had gone for a change of air by the advice of his physician. Mr. Pierston, Sr., it must be admitted, had been something miserly in his home life, as Marcia had so rashly reminded his son. But he had never stinted Jocelyn. He had been rather a hard taskmaster, though as a paymaster trustworthy, a ready money man, just and ungenerous. To everyone's surprise, the capital he had accumulated in the stone trade was of large amount for a business so unostentatiously carried on, much larger than Jocelyn had ever regarded as possible. While the son had been modeling and chipping his ephemeral fancies into perennial shapes, the father had been persistently chiseling for half a century at the crude original matter of those shapes, the stern, isolated rock in the channel, and by the aid of his cranes and pulleys, his trolleys and his boats, had sent off his spoil to all parts of Great Britain. When Jocelyn had wound up everything and disposed of the business, as recommended by his father's will, he found himself enabled to add about £80,000 to the £12,000 which he already possessed from professional and other sources. After arranging for the sale of some freehold properties in the island other than quarries, for he did not intend to reside there, he returned to town. He often wondered what had become of Marcia. He had promised never to trouble her, nor for a whole 20 years had he done so, though he had often sighed for her as a friend of sterling common sense and practical difficulties. Her parents were, he believed, dead, and she, he knew, had never gone back to the isle. Possibly, as he had formed some new tie abroad, and had made it next to impossible to discover her by her old name. A reposeful time ensued. Almost his first entry into society after his father's death occurred one evening, when, for want of knowing what better to do, he responded to an invitation sent by one of the few ladies of rank whom he numbered among his friends, and set out in a cab for the square wherein she lived during 3 or 4 months of the year. The hansom turned the corner, and he obtained a raking view of the houses along the north side, of which hers was one, with the familiar linkman at the door. There were Chinese lanterns, too, on the balcony. He perceived in a moment that the customary small and early reception. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.